Welcome to another episode of Steve's Speed Shop in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast's Bookshelf. Tonight, Speed Shop is a Between the Wars special. We're celebrating the magnificent motors of the 1920s and 1930s. And later in the show, we'll be asking which was the greatest pre-war people's car from this trio of legends. Was it the also-Italian Fiat Topolino, the little mouse? Was it the ever-so-English Austin 7? Or was it the all-American Ford Model T? And I'll be talking to a chap, Gilbert Sells of the Crettingham Crank Company, who sounds like he's straight out of a P.G. Wodehouse Jeeves and Wooster novel, but is actually a real person, and he's been building custom bikes for as long as I've been alive. But first, the other day, I found myself on the car park at Miller's Oils. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with their excellent automotive lubricants. And I was there to meet a man called James Baxter. Now, James holds the pre-war record at what is probably the most famous hill climb course in the whole world. I speak, of course, of Shelsley Walsh here in England. He's just uncovered a unique 1930s race car in Australia. It's been brought back to the UK, and James very graciously gave me 10 minutes of his time to tell me about this wonderful little car. So, James, tell us about this remarkable-looking car. I think because it's radio, obviously, there's a degree of description involved. We paint pictures with words, James. It's, as you imagine, a racing car to be, if it was sort of... if Mr. Todd owned a racing car, this is it.
Yeah, yeah, you're not too far off with that. So it's one man's dream of building himself a 1930s single-seater racing car. And it's got a bit of Lagondra about it, a bit of Riley about it, what he had in his garage at the time. And he decided to build this sort of ERA-ish looking little special, and he put his own mark on it, besides two big superchargers under the bonnet, one feeding the other, hence two staging it. And he came up with this contraption, because it's built out of Riley and Lagondra, a bit of an ABC special.
It's painted the best of British, the greatest hits
Britain's
motoring heritage from the 30s.
And then he decided to paint it red and green in Meccano colours, and that's why it sits in this beautiful livery.
So how old is it? Or is it hard to age because there's so many different motors that have contributed to this unique car?
Well, all the bits in it are pre-war, I have to say, which is fair play. I think it was conceived about 20 years ago, but it's only just landed in the UK, so I rather think it's going to take the VSCC by storm and prove what it can do for a little 1100cc car. And
well, as you say, it's a little 1100cc car. Where would that Lagondra engine have sat initially? It's got Lagondra on the covers, so
yeah.
I'm assuming it's Lagondra, but I thought you were going to say, it's not a Lagondra engine, it is.
No, it's a good honest lump, and it's the Rapier engine, so primarily this is all Lagondra Rapier stuff. So it may have been a two-seater road-going car, it might even have been a four-seater tourer body on it, who knows. So I don't know the history of the actual parts, but it's a good honest engine, just with a whacking great big supercharger on the front.
Yeah. Just explain how that works. Two superchargers in line. I suppose it's like if it was an electric car, putting batteries in line, and it kind of every time you put it in line, it doubles the power.
Well, it does. So you're squeezing it with the first blower, and then you're feeding pre-squeezed air into the next blower, so you squeeze it a bit more. So you're getting supercharging.
Supercharged.
Yeah.
Isn't there a point where you can't squeeze it anymore?
Well, the trouble is that the more you squeeze it, the warmer it gets, and that's the disadvantage. So you want cool, dense charge. So, yes, as you squash air, you naturally warm it, and that's an unfortunate byproduct, which is why we have intercoolers. There's also a limitation as to how much you can squash it in one stage with a roots blower, and these are roots blowers on here. So that's why they do it one stage with one blower and another stage with another blower. That's the principle of two staging.
If I ask you the silly question of how much brake horsepower this thing's knocking out, I've got a feeling I'm going to get the answer more than enough.
Yeah, more than enough, of course. It'll spin its wheels for... It'll rip crown wheel and pinions out the back axle quite merrily as well.
Wow.
I think this is... I've driven a few ERAs in my time. I think this is going to rival the best pre-war ERA times, and I think it's got about 200 horsepower at the wheels.
Good Lord.
Yeah, frightening, frightening stuff. Every time I go for a drive in it round the block, sorry, did I mention that? Every time I go for a drive on private airway, airstrips or whatever,
yes, of course.
I'm staggered by its performance. I come back smiling and the wife can't believe it. She says, what have you been doing? I said, I've been out in the Lagonda again. It's absolutely amazing.
How much of its history do you know, and how did you come to own the car, James?
Well, it was bought by a customer of mine 2 years ago, blind, at an auction. He rang me up and said, I bought this car. I wasn't there to bid. I bid over the phone. Can I have it delivered to your garage for you to commission? And I said, yeah, by all means, of course you can. The car arrived, and then the chap who owns it arrived a week later and said, what have I bought? I said, you've bought a little gem here. I said, I don't know much about its history, but it's a beautifully built thing.
And where had it been, James? You say it wasn't within these shores, within our septadile.
It was built in Australia by, I can't remember his, but Stewart. His surname was Stewart. I can't quite recall. I've got it in the paperwork at home.
A displaced Scotsman.
Maybe so, yes. But I have to say, an extremely talented engineer. Everything that I've done on the car, I go, ooh, I like that. Ooh, that's a good idea. It's just full of good ideas.
James, promise me something. You won't restore or pretty up this car. You'll leave it. Look at the patina. You can't buy it. You can't buy this sort of wear that's on this car that kind of tells the story of wherever and whatever it raced in. You must have some notion as to what it was built specifically for.
No, honestly, I think it was just one
sprinting, man. Sprinting, hill climbing?
Sprinting, hill climbing in Australia, yes. So it's now on UK shores, and it is a typical VSCC racing car because it's, you know, a bit of all bits combined together. But it was one man's passion and belief in himself, and he thought he could build a car. It did 134 miles an hour. When it arrived at auction, it had 134 on the side because the guy who built it had done 134 miles an hour in it.
Wow.
And then he fell ill and didn't really want it raced in Australia because he wouldn't be driving it. He was very happy when it left to go to that little island called England, never to be seen again.
As ever, I'll say. If you're wondering why we're both so massively impressed by 134 miles per hour, which doesn't seem to be any great shakes in this 21st century of ours, look on the Facebook page, Steve Speed Shop, and you'll see a picture of the car, and then I think anyone would think twice about doing those sorts of speeds.
Somebody this morning said, what's the boost pressure? I said, well, up to 10 PSI I could read the gauge, and after that everything was a blur. I was bobbing up and down, the car was bobbing up and down. It's a lively thing. Yeah, it focuses yourself. You've got to concentrate.
So how's it transferring that 134 brake horsepower to tarmac, James?
Well, it's doing it through a little 4-speed Riley gearbox, and then it's going down through the prop shaft, which has been lowered so the driver can sit lower still, through his own privately made gearbox, which has got fins on the outside to cool it, back up into a standard differential and out to the wheels. So, you know, he's conceived his own transfer gearbox as well, just to get the weight distribution down.
Yeah.
And I've had all that apart because the crown wheel and pinion, unfortunately, was a weak link in the system. I've put a new crown wheel and pinion in, and now it's all good. But again, every nut and bolt I've had apart, I'm just full of admiration for the bloke who did it. I'd actually love to meet him. I'm not sure if he's still alive. I might actually have to find out.
Other mystery components is the stuff on this car where you're looking at it and thinking, it might be Riley.
Oh, indeed.
It might be Austin.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, the crown wheel and pinion, I went to various Lagonda Rapier people and they said, it ain't one of ours, pal. That ain't Lagonda Rapier. So I went to there are only two people in England who can make spiral bevel gears. I went to my gear specialist in Hull and I said, what is it? Can you make me another one? He said, yeah, I can make you one similar, same ratio but stronger. By the way, what the heck is it out of? And I said, well, this funny old special that came from Australia. He said, that crown wheel and pinion came from a dumper truck. It's agricultural. He said that.
Well, presumably out there. I mean, here in England, we're used to being, more than anywhere else in the world, maybe there's a small part of Italy, maybe in California, you get the same sort of access to specialist historic motor racing parts.
That's right.
But out there in Australia, maybe he was looking at a Ferguson or a New Holland and, and thinking, or maybe I wonder if that'll fit on the car.
Yeah, what he had in his garage, you just got to manage, haven't you? It's like when you're rallying and going across India, you stop and you cast a new gearbox casing if you have to, don't you? You just got to, the engineer in you has to make do with what he has.
So what does it run on, James? Regular unleaded?
Yeah, sure.
No.
Well, you need a squirt of that in the carburetor to start it, and then once the fuel pump's got up to pressure, it starts pumping the neat methanol through, so it's basically 100%
neat
alcohol.
Neat, yeah. 100% alcohol.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you've got a lower calorific value than petrol, so you're pumping in about roughly 2.2 times the volume of a petrol car. Mm. And that's what the orange disc stickers on the side mean, because if you catch fire
you
with methanol,
see it, can you?
You can't see it's an invisible flame.
Yeah.
Although we do put additives in this to give it a visible flame.
Oh, that's handy, so you actually know when you're on fire.
Indeed.
That's always useful,
yeah,
isn't
it's a
it,
pleasure.
James?
Yeah.
So it's going to put the cat amongst the pigeons,
this
car,
it is.
Isn't
oh,
it?
Big time. I can't wait. And it's going to be a little bit rude, because it, you know, it's built out of bits and it's arrived on the scene. It's going to be a bit rude. It's going to turn a few heads, and I'm extremely excited about it.
And so it's competition debut over here?
It will probably be early VSCC next season now, because we've hit sort of autumn time and we're all starting to wrap them up for the winter. It could be a Harewood Hill Climb next year, I would think, by the owner.
Right.
Yeah.
And, I was going to say, does it stop? I've just had a look at the brakes. They're huge. Yes, it does stop.
They're not bad, actually, yeah. It's hydraulic brakes on all four wheels.
Blimey. From its original build, or they've been added surely later on?
I would think that Lagonda Rapier ran cable or rod brakes, so that might be a nod of... it still could be pre-war on hydraulic, so it's a pre-war fair dues, really.
It's amazing, isn't it, James, that cars like this still turn up? Unknown cars, incredible cars like this, can still pop up and surprise everyone.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, they're in barns, and they're not all unknown. Some of them are known about, but you've just got to wait for the old boy to pass on or die or whatever.
You've just got to wait for someone to snuff it so you can get your hands on his car.
Absolutely. Drag it out and get it running again.
It's great, though, that it comes out and he's raced in anger once again. How long do you think it's been out of competition?
Oh, I would think 10, 15 years. It's just been languishing. It's passed through a few hands and no one's really got hold of it. It's a delicate car, and you've got to know what you're doing with methanol. You've got to have a bit of experience, and I suspect the last two owners didn't have, in all fairness, but I'm sure I'm the man for it.
Does it have a name? I bet it has a name, this car. Is it called 134? Is that what you call it?
Well, it was known as the 134 car, yeah. My little lad comes in the garage, and because of the shape of the tail, it's sort of got a pointy red tail, for the sake of radio. My little lad calls it the strawberry car. But
great.
There you go. Whatever you want,
strawberry
really.
Car. Well, whatever you call it, 134, the strawberry car. It's an extraordinary motor, James. We'll have some pictures of it up on our Facebook page, and... as you say, look out for it next year, maybe at the Harewood Hill Climb. That's in North Yorkshire in England.
Indeed.
And I'm sure it'll pop up on places like Chumley and Goodwood. And
oh, yeah. Prescott, Shelsley, it'll be out and about, yeah.
Across the world, 24 hours a day. This is Fat Boy U.
Welcome back to Steve's Speed Shop, in association with those good people at Douglas Loveridge Publications, the Enthusiasts Bookshelf. Tonight's Speed Shop is a Between the Wars special, and just the other day, I found myself talking to a chap with a Between the Wars name, Gilbert Sells of the Crettingham Crank Company. It sounds, doesn't it, straight out of the pages of a P.G. Wodehouse novel. The sort of workshop where Jeeves would take Bertie's roadster to have the crankshaft retrued, the valves ground, and all of the universal joints greased. But it's not. He's a real person. He used to be a Formula One mechanic with Lotus. He's been building custom bikes for over half a century. He's a very cool and distinctive individual. He was stood next to a bike that identified itself as a 1936 Ariel. I could see there was a lot more going on than just that, and this is our conversation. So you are, sir, tell us your name.
I'm Gilbert Sills of the Crettingham Crank Company.
The Crettingham Crank Company.
Yeah, crank as in this sort, not on the roundy-roundy type.
The one that's between the ears and the one that's rather between the legs, or between the ankles at least. We're in the exhibition hall here at Copdoc Bike Show, which is one of the biggest bike shows in the UK. And there are many and various high-end classics in here, Laverdas, Triumphs, Vincents even. But the bike that's getting the most attention is yours. Tell us about this. It is.
Well, as I said, it's just a collection of old bits, really. The engine is a 1927 side valve 750 Jap, which reputedly came out of a forklift truck working in the carpet factory in Kidderminster.
Oh, you're joking.
The frame is a 1936 Ariel. Front forks are 1932-33 matchless. Gearbox is a 30s Norton. And the newest thing, bits on the whole bike, are Triumph hubs, which are 1938. So everything on it is pre-war. make my own tanks and seats and generally bolt the whole thing together.
When I see a bike like this, if I'm in Los Angeles or I'm in London or I'm in Paris, being the international jet-setting journalist that I am, it's normally ridden by someone who's considerably younger than yourself and a bit of a sort of a...
Well, you've got to do something, spend your pension money on something,
haven't
you?
A bit of a fashion player. I was expecting the owner of this bike to be a bit of a Hollywood A-list lookalike or maybe a rock star or something like that, because this is a very fashionable motorcycle. This is exactly the sort of thing that the hip young dudes are smoking about Hollywood or the East Shoreditch in London, or if you turn up somewhere on the Champs-Élysées for a fashion lodge. This is the sort of thing that the lads are... Well, nothing as nice as this, not as high-end as this. I mean, this is an amazing bike, and you did almost all of it yourself. Where did the inspiration come from to build it? Was it just, did you look at the engine and think, I must do something with that engine?
Well, I inherited the engine off a friend, and I already had the gearbox and I had the wheels, and every auto jumble I trawl around, see what I can find, and think, that looks a bit worn out, but I think I can fix that. I take all these bits home, and then I sit there and look at it and drink plenty of whiskey and
what kind of whiskey?
Any old stuff, rough the better. Don't go for taste, just effect. And I've tried to recreate a 1930s Brooklands racer,
right,
in its original guise. It had a lot lower bars and the foot pegs were right back here, but about 15-20 miles and that was it. I'd needed a complete rebuild myself, so I've raised the bars, raised the seat, put the foot pegs further forward. But it's a nice little bike to ride.
The sort of bike that you would have got your gold star for, a certified 100 mile per hour plus
that would be like,
of the
would
Brooklyn
be nice.
Circuit.
But Noel Pope is one of my heroes, so he's a damn good bloke, Noel.
What's
Pope.
Your biking story?
Well, motor racing, really.
Yeah.
I'm an ex-Formula One mechanic. Worked for Team Lotus in the late 70s. And
why are so many people involved in the high end of four-wheel motorsport, closet motorcycle freaks?
Well, I've always built, I've always been building bikes nearly all my life. After I packed up motor racing, I then went and started my own business doing a lot of fabrication work and so on. But motor racing teaches you all these skills, such as, machining, fabrication work.
Well, it used to, didn't it?
Yeah, it used to.
Do you think it's
no.
Do you think it's
in
different?
In my day, mechanics used to have toolboxes. I think now we're laptops or something.
3D printing, CNC machining. It's a very different
world,
isn't
it? Well, I've
got
a 1960 mill, and probably a 60s lathe as well. Yeah, they're not accurate, but, I do what I want to do with them, which I thoroughly enjoy doing it. I don't employ people anymore, and I'm happy as Larry. Sometimes I'm down in my workshop at 4 o'clock in the morning because I want to be, and sometimes I'm still there at 10 o'clock.
Are you one of those guys who cleverly, when they were giving away Vincents, and they were, I mean, people forget there was a time when old Gold Stars and Norton Dommies and even Vincents and Bruffs were just old bikes and nobody.
Well,
wanted
you look
them.
At the price of Bruffs nowadays; they're ridiculous.
Yeah,
even these old side valve engines. Yeah, all 20 years ago, I would have haggled over 20 quid for the thing.
Wow.
But now these things are about 3,000-4,000 quid.
Even for one that used to be, what did you say, in a factory in Wolverhampton?
Yeah, in a carpet factory in Kidderminster in a forklift. But I got another bigger one in the other tent over there, and that's got a 1323cc V-twin in it, side valve.
Yeah. So the difficulty that a lot of people would have in other parts of the world is getting a registration plate on this thing and getting the authorities to accept what it is.
Yeah, well, I bought this one with a V5, so...
Yeah, the original aerial frame is what the number goes with.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that it's a Jap engine, JAP Presswitch, of course, not Japanese, and the Norton gearbox, as far as the DVLA are concerned here in the UK, that's irrelevant.
No, it's all been I've sent away, sent the form back, got the correct engine number fitted for the frame. Insuring them can be a bit of a pain. But, my only real criticism of this thing is these bloody brakes.
It
doesn't stop very well.
So what?
But it goes. That little 750, I've put a bigger inner manifold on it. I've done a really nice porting job on it. This thing goes. I'm not kidding you. It's quick.
Well, what'll it do, mister? Go on, what do you reckon?
Well, I haven't had it absolutely flat yet because I'm still playing about with carburation, but yeah, it's good for probably 80, 85 mile an hour out of a forklift engine, which is going some, isn't it?
I did the London to Brighton bike run a few years ago, and I'd previously done the car event three times on one of the slowest cars that's in the entire event, an 1897 Leon Bollé tri-car. Mm. We tried three times. We didn't even finish. This thing was like a dog kennel with a strimmer mower strapped to it. So as a reward for my persistence, the curator of the National Motor Museum, Doug Hill, said, I'm going to give you the superbike of the Edwardian era, a 1911 matchless board track racer with the 1000cc Jap engine in it. And I thought he was exaggerating, so I turned up at the start line and I said, how fast is this thing, Doug? And he went, I'll do 90. I don't think people realise how much power and how fast bikes were relatively early on in the development of the motorcycle.
Yeah, you've got a big engine in the thing, and it's a big old long stroke thing.
On methanol, of course.
If it's on methanol, that will make it go, and it will help it in as much as it doesn't get too hot. Because one of the problems with these old side valves, they haven't got much compression. This thing originally had 4.2, so I've upped it to a heady 5 to 1. But in traffic, you can feel the heat coming off it. Well, this one isn't so bad, but the big DTZ...
What do you run this one on?
Yeah, just ordinary petrol.
Just ordinary petrol. You don't put anything in it?
No.
Wow. It wasn't designed to run on that, was it?
No, but it survives on it. Seems to enjoy it.
So, it's such a... Does it seem odd to you that a bike that you've built because your heroes are... Well, you said no Pope, so we're talking between the wars, aren't we?
Yeah.
And before that... Mm. When the Brooklyn Circuit was, you know, the world's first purpose-built motor racing circuit was in its pomp. Does it seem unusual to you that this bike that you've cobbled together out of some bits that you had lying around is incredibly, it's on the cutting edge of motorcycle fashion in 2015? There are hipsters, like I say, in LA and Paris and Tokyo that would kill for this bike, literally kill for this bike.
I'm a bit too much in love with it. It's not for sale yet.
But what about the brakes? What are you going to do about these brakes?
Well, they're gradually bedding in, but I've just got used to it now. But it teaches you how to go around corners in a hurry.
Great.
If you can't stop, you've got to crank the thing in and
hang on. If you can't stop, look for a gap. That's always been my theory.
Yeah.
Don't accept that you're going to have an accident. Right until the very last split second, there's usually a gap, and sometimes
you can knock it down a gear, but risk over revving the thing. And I don't want to break this engine because it's just such a nice little lump.
It is. Well, it's a great looking bike. Out of all the bikes in here, and there are some very special motorcycles in this exhibition hall, it's the one that's caught my eye. It's the one that's caught the eye of a lot of people that have come here today. It's a fantastic bike, and it's a credit to you, and a delight to speak to you, sir. Thank you.
Embrace the alternative. This is Fab Radio International.
It's time for that part of show that we call the greatest. The premise is a very simple one. We're trying to find the greatest motor car of them all. We've started with a not-so-short list of 99 cars. We pick three against each other each week. At some point, we'll get through the 33 categories that we created, and then we'll add a wild card to the 11 we already had, and then we'll pick 12 cars against each other, and eventually, by discourse, intelligent discourse, informed discussion, and some bare-knuckle boxing, we will arrive at the greatest motor car of all time. This week, we're talking about pre-war people's cars, which was the greatest pre-war, blue-collar, working-class people's car. Was it the Ford Model T? Was it the Fiat Topolino, the little mouse? Or was it our very own British Austin 7? I'm joined by Guy Loveridge, the chairman of the Guild of Motoring Writers.
Good morning.
And by Dave Richards, who is a journalist, and we can't say what he's doing right now because he's going to be on the telly and it's a bit top secret, isn't it, Dave?
It is a little bit, so I won't talk about that, Steve.
Right, okay. Not too much anyway.
Indeed not.
So, Dave Richards, the Austin 7, surely the greatest pre-war people's car, a miracle of packaging, and how did they do it for the price?
Exactly. How on earth did Herbert Austin create this tiny little car at such a little low price and then sell it to almost anybody who needed that transport? And, of course, from the Austin 7 stems the manufacture of cars by other companies, such as BMW, such as Nissan in Japan. and such as the American Austin company that also produced Austin 7s under license. What a fantastic little car, and incredibly significant in the way it got other manufacturers off the ground making cars.
I think, Guy, it was people might be encouraged to think that Austin were relatively humble makers of motor cars. Almost a cycle car. It's almost what they called a cycle car, the 7, isn't it? Which was kind of a dog kennel with a motorbike engine strapped to it.
But Very nearly.
Austin had been, prior in their early days, makers of very grand vehicles indeed. It was a radical departure for them, wasn't it, Guy?
It was. Herbert Austin's background was with Wolseley. He was a designer for the Wolseley Sheep Shearing Company, bizarrely enough, and that was a sideways move into the motor industry for him.
I'm glad you put your teeth in this morning, Guy.
Coming out of the First World War, 1919-1920, Austin, like many established industrialists, had done very well out of the First World War. The armaments race was very good for business. But he recognised that transport could not be of the colonial style six-seater mini charabang that's still 18 foot long and 2.5 tons.
Driven by chauffeurs.
Exactly. He knew that egalitarianism, the rise of socialism, let's not shy away from it. There'd been a revolution in Russia in 1917. He knew that the man in the street was going to want to get out and about, and the man in the street who up to the First World War perhaps would have had a motorcycle, maybe a motorcycle and a sidecar, he had aspirations.
Perhaps a car fit for heroes as well as a home fit for heroes.
Absolutely, taking on the Lloyd George mantra of the post-First World War years, and this gave... It was one of the first £100 cars, and even though that was a year and a bit salary, it was a heck of a lot cheaper than anything else around.
Dave Richards, how much can we credit the 18-year-old Stanley Edge for the design of the Austin 7?
Well, it's the design of any piece of industrial equipment, as it were, is teamwork, isn't it? Anything we do is teamwork. Even like sitting on Steve's Speed Shop talking to the great Steve Berry, there's always three people talking about the cars in front of us. And so it's teamwork that ends up with a great result.
I'm going to let that pass. Thank you, Dave. This was the guy, the 18-year-old Stanley Edge, who spent many hours in the billiard room with Herbert Austin. That's not a euphemism.
But what was the address of the billiard room?
Well, I know he lived at Licky Grange.
Licky Grange, yes.
Yeah, Licky Grange. And the reason I know he lived at Licky Grange is because we used to go there and film a lot of Top Gear back in the day. When the budget was the same as Jeremy Clarkson's lunch bill for an entire programme, instead of going to Antarctica or Tahiti to film episodes of Top Gear, we used to leave BBC Birmingham and head to Licky Grange, which is a very lovely and leafy part of the Midlands, isn't it, Dave?
It is. It's just outside Longbridge. It's not very far away at all. And so it was very convenient for the design team to sort of spend time over the billiard table ensuring that the Austin 7 was going to be the right car at the right price. And there is elements of the design of an Austin 7 that sort of leave something to be desired, that the chassis isn't two chunks of metal side by side joined together. It's basically like a triangle. And, of course, a triangle has a stronger shape, but it reduced the amount of metal that had to go into the car. Again, the engine only got two main bearings to start with. The three-bearing engine didn't come in until 1937. And so there's ways in which the costs were being kept down to ensure this vision that the man in the street could have a genuine motor car and not have to ride around on a buckboard contraption with a lawnmower engine strapped to it.
I like the sound of a buckboard contraption, but as you say, Dave, what a great engine. Just 700 cc's and only 7.5 horsepower, but an aluminium crankcase, a cast iron block, a cast iron cylinder head, cooling by thermosiphon without a water bump. It's a masterpiece of minimalism, isn't it, Guy?
Absolutely. The distillation of everything Austin had learned from stationary engines and all internal combustion on different scales from single cylinders up to multi-cylinders, all put down to a very simple side valve package that essentially anyone in the street could service. I have a friend who has raced Austin 7s, and when he bought a spare engine, which was running in the car that it was taken out of, he ran it, he did a season's racing, we decided to do a decoke. We opened it, and piston number 3 was made of wood.
Honestly?
Quite hand on heart, honestly. And he'd won a championship racing that car.
I've ridden a Lambretta that had a flywheel that was made out of cast iron instead of the light alloy that had previously been there. It ran a bit odd.
I bet it did.
I've never found a wooden piston. Listen, despite what people might believe from listening to the show every week, I do some research, genuinely, for the show. And I was reading up on the Austin 7 and I found a great story on an Austin 7 fan site. And it was a guy who'd been a pistol shooting champion in his youth. And this would have been just after the Second World War. And to get to the competitions that he took part in at the weekend at places like Bisley, the rifle ranges here in England, or Altcar up in the northwest, he had got an Austin 7 out of a field and he'd built it into a special. The story concluded with him on the way to the concluding round of this British pistol shooting championship and kind of potentially being able to win the championship, but his Austin 7 terminally breaking down. Somebody told him there was one in a field about a mile away, so him and his mate walked to where it was, removed the engine, carried the engine back to where their stricken 7 was, put a crankshaft in the engine at the side of the rod and continued on their way. And guess what? He won the championship.
Fantastic.
Anybody else got a story of idly replacing a crankshaft? And somebody saying, oh yeah, there's one of those just up the road. Because they made how many of these, Guy? 300,000?
300,000, yeah.
From 1922 to 1939 when the unpleasantness began.
Indeed.
Yeah. Although, I think, and Dave's already mentioned this, so I may be repeating what Dave's already said, but the origins of BMW as a car company as we know them in the 7, with the license-built Dixie, and all the irony these days when companies like Mitsubishi and Nissan and Toyota complain about Chinese copies of their car, wasn't the 7 actually pirated, if you will, if that's the right term, by the Japanese?
It was cloned. They bought one, exported it, and started copying it. And Herbert Austin decided it wasn't worth taking legal action because the Japanese motor industry would never amount to anything.
Can we move on to the Fiat Topolino? The little mouse. What an attractive little car, Guy. What a great looking car for such... I mean, so stylish for something that looks like it should have a big key sticking out of the back.
It is. It has a sort of sub-Chrysler airflow front end. It's got headroom and it's got a wheel at each corner, which is always perceived to be the good starting point for a four-wheel motor car. Loads of them made. Over 500,000 Topolinos made over a much longer career than the 7, 36 to 55. But the Italian working man's car, everyone wanted one, everyone could have one. The direct precursor of the Fiat 500.
I'm not sure about that, but we'll come back to that in just a second. Dave, is this the birth of what we, that jargon word, I'm not madly keen on it, but I can't think of a better way of describing what it does and is. Is this the beginning of packaging in motor cars?
I think it is. It's a car that definitely had styling. And when you look at what was going on in Italy in the 1930s, given that the architects of some unpleasantness were not nice people, but the people they had around them in Italy in the 30s as designers were phenomenal. And this little Fiat, it's just a great-looking thing. And when you drive one down the road, small children leap off the pavement and shout, "Nice car, mister," at you because it's so cute. It's almost like, do you remember watching Noddy when you were a kid?
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Noddy's car is practically the same design as a Fiat Topolino.
It's a convertible Topolino, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Mm.
Great thing.
But, I mean, said that, Guy, they raced them today in the retrospective Mille Miglia. They raced them at the time in the Mille Miglia.
They did, but that speaks as much to the Italian
character,
national psyche, if you like. If it goes, I'll race it.
Well, and also the way the Italians built motor cars was the same as the Germans in the 30s. You know, the motorways had just come in and been laid with slave labour or cheap labour or whatever. But then the cars that were around needed to be able to be driven at top speed flat out then all day down a motorway. And I think the fact that we didn't have motorways in Britain hampered the British motor industry in being able to create this sort of robust durability at top speed that you find in a Topolino.
I'm going to take issue, though, with this idea of a people's car. The projected price when it emerged in 1936 was 5,000 lira. It was 10,000 when it actually came. So it was the idea was let's... And here's the thing, and when we talk about the Model T, this is going to probably be the most significant thing that we discuss rather than the engineering or the design. It's kind of who it was meant for, who it was made for, why it was made, is that America was in a different place to either the UK or Italy. The truth is that when the Austin 7 came out in 1922, and then when the Topolino emerged in 1936, looking as cute as it is, truly... both were beyond the working man, realistically. When they said the working man, they meant an accountant, or they meant a professional man, a doctor,
that's right. I mean,
a bank manager.
The Topolino was priced in England at £298 at the same time the Austin 7 was priced at £100. Mm. So it was a dear car in Britain. And also it was perceived as difficult to maintain because it was foreign. That great British attitude that if it's foreign, then therefore it is somehow not
xenophobia rules. Yeah.
My father remains unconvinced that he would think the same today. Honestly, I'd sit there and my dad, I turned up yesterday. I've got, as you know, Dave, I bought a new old Alfa, and I turned up at it, and my parents hadn't seen it, and my dad sort of, all he did was, my mum came out to look at it. She loves cars. My mother had a Fiat 500. She was one of the first people in the UK to own a Fiat 500, which of course is directly descended from the Topolino, because my grandfather was a Fiat dealer. But my dad just kind of, he didn't even come outside. I saw him raise his head from his, he was sat in his chair by the window, and he sort of looked at the Alfa disapprovingly. I don't know what he was thinking. He was thinking, foreign thing, nothing but trouble. But this gets back to, is it partly because, as we were saying, that this 7 guy was pure car? There was nothing there on that vehicle that wasn't employed in the purpose of moving. How many people can actually get in a 7? Can 4 people get in a 7, really?
Yes, the later ones, the longer wheelbase ones, yeah. Not a Ruby, an Austin 7 Ruby, you can easily get 4 adults.
Because the Topolino, which was available in a bewildering variety of body styles. I mean, you could get a standard coupe, a cabriolet, there was a van, there was a regular coupe, there was the Belvedere, which is the one that looked like you took an American station wagon of the same era and just shrank it and then shrank it again and then shrank it a little bit more. And there was a delightful little van.
Yes, for deliveries of thimbles and matchboxes.
I think the truth, the thing about the Italian people's car is it's not a car. It's the scooter that was made by Lambretta and Vespa, made by Innocenti and Piaggio.
With 4 wheels, yeah.
Piaggio after the war. And then I think in Italy, the first true people's car is the 500.
The new over 500,
yeah. Because
yeah.
People catch up. The working population of a nation actually catches up with the aspirations of car makers. Car makers seem to be always a little bit in front and say, look, we built a people's car, and people go, oh, that's about twice as much as I was hoping to spend on a car. I'll stick with my bicycle or my Vespa or my BSA Bantam, thank you very much.
Yes.
Which brings us to the only true people's car, I think, out of these three, which is the incredible Ford Model T. And let's have both of you giving me one good reason, you first, Dave, one good reason why the Ford Model T should not just be the winner this week of our three-way battle, but should not be at the end of all this identified as the greatest motor car of all time. You first, Dave.
Well, I'm going to be greedy, Steve, and give two reasons. And the first reason is one that you will completely identify with, which is that out of all the three cars in the group for this show, the only car that was manufactured in Manchester was the Ford Model T. Mm. And I thought you might like that idea.
Indeed.
And the second is that when a chap called Nick Giordano started producing his Encyclopedia of the Motor Car back in the sort of late 1960s, early 70s, the slipcover of that very first edition encyclopedia, the one car on the picture is a Model T Ford. Mm. So even in 1968, in the first edition of the Encyclopedia of the Motor Car, which many, many classic car journalists have on their desks as a work of reference, and there is the most significant car ever made, the Model T Ford.
Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you for completely stealing my thunder in the next bit, which was that I was going to say that if Guy Loveridge would care to just crane his neck ever so slightly and look out of the window behind me, you can see
the actual site of the very first Ford Motor Company car plant outside of the USA, and a site where the Model T was built and where Henry Ford came and was greatly encouraged to see that British workers actually did a better and quicker job of making his motor cars. He wanted to expand his Manchester plant, but as this was the busiest and most prolific industrial area in the world at the time, there wasn't any room. And so he got the right ump and relocated to Dagenham. But you mentioned it already, Dave, so I shan't. Guy Loveridge, why isn't the Model T not just the greatest car that we're talking about today, but the greatest car of all time?
Yes, because it didn't evolve.
Ah, that is a very good point. Built between 1908 and 1928.
If you look at what happened to the Austin 7 between 22 and 39, you could almost argue that the the product labelled an Austin 7 is very little related. The first Austin 7s that were sold, cable-operated brakes, only to one set of wheels, non-linked brakes, a slightly under 747cc engine with 1.5 bearing crankshaft. I think Dave was being a bit kind saying it's a 2 bearing. But by the end of the production in 1939, it had grown 6 inches in the wheelbase. You had a 3 bearing crankshaft engine. Along the way, you had Austin 7 racing cars that were guaranteed to do 80 miles an hour. You had supercharged cars. You had 4-wheel brakes on them, fully linked. It grew up. The same with the Topolino. Through its production career, it evolved into a much more refined and got cheaper motor car.
Yeah, it got
Whereas
cheaper.
The T,
yeah.
Pretty much a last Model T, as if you'd given it to the owner of a first Model T, he'd have known which bits to hit and which bits to press.
Front-mounted 2.9-litre, 177 cubic inch, as they would have identified it at the Highland Park plant just outside Detroit.
2.9-litre.
Yes, 4-cylinder engine producing 20 brake horsepower, a top speed of about 45 miles an hour. The last time I drove one flat out, it felt like considerably faster than 45 miles an hour. Because, of course, you've got to remember which control does which and which pedal and which lever does which. Because, of course, the layout for a modern motorist is utterly unconventional. But get this, it would do 20 miles to the gallon on gasoline, kerosene or ethanol. And would do its top speed across a ploughed field, a longer... In fact, it would plough a field. I've just been looking. Well, the origins of the Fordson tractor are in the Model T.
Yes.
You could buy a kit to turn a Model T into a tractor, and it was incredibly popular. People used the Model T. Basically, Dave, it was kind of a mechanized mule, wasn't it? It would fulfill the job that any beast of burden had done before its inception.
It would do, but there were some issues with the drivetrain on the car. So the car only has 2 gears, and these are planetary gears, and that's what led the Americans to introduce 2 stages of driving license. Basically, there was a driving license for cars, and then a driving license for vehicles with the two-stage planetary
gear
train.
So the Model T, because by 1918, more than half the cars in the USA were 4 Model Ts. That's after 10 years of production.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I don't think any manufacturer ever will be able to achieve those sort of figures. I know the Volkswagen Beetle eventually sold more units, but the T, retaining its sort of design integrity, just being what it is and being sold for what it is, what a great thing. And the price just came down and down and down and down. Year on year on year, the price reduced and reduced and reduced.
So what is the Model T? Not Guy Loveridge, and I think we're talking about the means of production. What is the fact that everyone who minds you about cars in a pub without actually really knowing anything about cars got, oh yes, the Model T, that was the very first.
Everyone says it's the first car to be made on a production line, which it wasn't. Ransom Eli Olds was producing curved dash Oldsmobiles on a production line in 1903.
The annoying thing about that is that it's not even, the derivation of it isn't even right, because they'll go, oh yes, sorry to be that boring person, but I won't do this voice for long.
If the voice fits.
If the voice fits. Oh yes, Henry Ford saw the Springfield repeating rifle being produced on a production line. It's not true. That's not even the derivation. Where it was derived from. It was actually Henry Ford's inspiration was meat production in Chicago. He saw the way that the stockyards in Chicago, which was, you know,
the slaughterhouse of America, if you will. And he saw the way that the carcasses of beasts were processed.
Longhorn cattle in one end, steaks out the other end.
And that's where he got his... It's doubly annoying. But
the Model T is the vehicle out of these three that has the most urban myths about it as well, because there's also the phrase, any colour you like as long as it's black.
Yeah,
but
that's nonsense as well.
But that didn't come in until quite a way into the production.
And it was also just a quip from Henry Ford at a dinner. It was never a fact. David Burgess Wise has done great research into the Manchester plant, for example, and he said, no, they had 27 colours available.
Yeah,
you know, 27 colours. No, they're not all just monotone shades of black.
And that quip came about because Henry Ford knew that the black ones that they were painting, the paint dried the fastest, and therefore he had the most profit in the black ones.
They got out the door faster.
He wanted to sell more black ones because it was
so
more profitable.
That's the second most famous misquote of Henry Ford's after History is Bunk, which of course. Yeah. Is again a complete misquote from Mr. Henry Ford. 1909, a Model T, they made 11,000 of them in that year. Of course, they'd subsequently go on to produce 16.5 million cars in 20 years, would have cost you around $20,000 US. So, truthfully, it was, as Henry Ford said, his ambition had been to produce a motor car that was affordable to a working man with some kind of aspirations to get on in the world and do better for himself, as was his personal philosophy. And I think if we look at the average price of what would a Mondeo, is the Mondeo called the Mondeo around the world now? The Ford, the five-door Ford family car that we have here in the UK, the Mondeo.
I'm pretty sure it's the global car,
It's the global car. So if we say that a Model T was $20,000 US, then it's true. It was the kind of car that could have been afforded by a working man.
That ethos has never left the Ford range. There has always been that car, the aspirational, slightly better than maybe you've got, something within the range that allows you to move up, but gives you an access point to something that is upwardly mobile, to use a horrible 80s phrase.
Can I nominate the Model T as well for being the origin of sort of industrial recycling? You know what? Henry Ford used to make the offcuts from the Model T. You know, we used that. Henry Ford started a charcoal-making company. All the wooden bits from the T were recycled as the King's Ford Charcoal Company.
My goodness.
So, yeah, there's another reason to... Let's call it, guys. Guy Loveridge, 3-2-1. The Ford Model T, the Austin 7, the Fiat Topolino, which is the greatest pre-war... blue-collar, working-class, everyday car?
Three, the Topolino, because it wasn't really that working-class.
It wasn't.
But it led to, as you said, Italian societal change post-World War II led to the 500, which was the Topolino's scion. So, yes, it did, but it's not quite there. Two, despite the fact that it tugs at my heartstrings...
It was your first car, wasn't it?
And it was the first car I ever drove, an Austin 7. It has to come in second place. If we'd slightly changed the question, it would have won, but we didn't, so it hasn't. Number one, it's got to be the Model T. There's no argument.
Right. You love production figures and sales figures, don't you, as an indication of greatness or otherwise?
I do, but as...
But you're not even a car salesman. You're a journalist, for
goodness sake. As unit to unit, if
Grubby
we had...
Grubby commerce guy, that surely can't be an indication of greatness.
If we had three of them together next to each other, then I'd choose an Austin 7, without a shadow of a doubt. But if we had three of them together...
The nicest to drive is the Topolino.
And we plucked Giuseppe, Stan and Hank... from their era,
stereotypes on
them, and put them next to each car. Hank would have the most compelling argument for taking that Model T and driving it away.
Absolutely,
I firmly believe.
Dave, 3-2-1.
Number three, Topolino. One of the things I love about the Topolino is that during the 1960s and 70s, drag racers took the Topolino bodies and stuck them on drag racing cars.
Well, hey,
because they were tiny and really cheap.
Front end and back end of a Topolino.
Go on,
Cooper 500.
Yeah,
well. But it's not a reason to call the car's greatness, is it? It's just an interesting side fact. Second, and as Guy says, we're talking about the car and not about the car's significance. So second is the Austin 7, even though I adore the things. Mm. And then top has got to be the Model T, even though our history, we're so far away from its significance now, even through the blur of the 20th century and all our own histories with it, we can still sense that that vehicle was about the most significant vehicle ever made.
Yeah. The Ford Model T, the first automobile built in various countries simultaneously. So it invented that. It invented advertising and marketing for cars. And the guy's pulling a face. There's virtually no point in me saying it. I'm going to go three with the Topolino, although I love them, and it's the nicest car to drive today out of the three. The 7 was a hugely significant car. You can look at the modern Nissan and BMW as giants of the car industry, and they find their origins in this little car.
We're not talking legacy. If we're talking legacy, Sir William Lyons, Jaguar. First car that he made was an Austin 7 Special.
Are you two just going to jump in and say the next thing that I was going to say? Because that's what I was going to say. You are, aren't you? Which is fine. I was going to say, without Austin, the Austin 7, no Jaguar, Sir William Lyons, as he subsequently became, began building his swallow-bodied Austin 7s.
And later, of course.
And they are beautiful cars. And the first Lotus was an Austin 7, truthfully. The first
Bruce McLaren's first competition car.
McLaren was an Austin 7. The first Malloc was an Austin 7.
The engine carried on being produced by Reliant until 1961.
Yeah, Dave, the things that I said were all good things.
Well, that's what we like about Speed Shop is the balance, isn't it? The nice balance.
The Austin 7.
I like the naked prejudice and the shouting. those are the bits that I like.
Giuseppe, Hank and Stan, come back.
I have had some feedback from our American listeners. Bizarrely, what's normally three bits arguing in a studio in Manchester, opposite the very first Ford Motor Company plant outside of the US, is we're wildly popular in the States. And people feel we have some anti-American bias. There is no anti-American bias on display today. The Ford Model T is not just the greatest out of these three great cars. All great cars. We usually have a whipping boy, don't we?
Usually a Morgan, actually. But there, we go.
There are no whipping boys this week. They're all three exceptional, truly exceptional. Each one of them transcending their status as a device, a motor vehicle. In the Topolino's case, for bad, the Topolino is an example of fascist Italy trying to make Italy look like more of a successful country and a more powerful, prestigious, successful nation than it actually was, at the expense of the Italian people. They were priced out of that car. It wasn't a working man's car. It wasn't a people's car. It was far too expensive. The Model T is everything that's good about America in this era. It's about dreams. It's about freedom. It's about
Hitler saying that it was the only acceptable car until the Volkswagen went into production.
Thank you, Guy. It's about success.
We talked about the Model T without mentioning Laurel and Hardy?
We have.
Well, I was going to move on to celebrity owners and say, apart from the Keystone Cops and Laurel and Hardy, the Model T is one of the greatest cars of all time. End of story. So many things about it were firsts, and in many ways, it gave inspiration to car makers in other countries to produce a car that was affordable and reliable and durable and practical in the way that the Model T. It's the original people's car, and it was very much Henry Ford, who I think is the greatest individual in the history of the motor car. I honestly do. Because there are many other people that we admire who produce great cars, fabulous sports cars, super fast racing cars. We can look at the Enzo Ferraris and the Gordon Murrays of this world and consider them to be great. But when we consider the greatest individual in the history of the motor car, I think it has to be Henry Ford. And this is his finest achievement. And I think at the end of all these conversations, the 33 conversations that we're going to have in the greatest to try and whittle our 99 cars down to the greatest, I think the Model T Ford is going to be right there at the very end, duking it out with possibly two or three other cars for the title of the greatest.
Agreed. It's a mould breaker. The Model T reinvented what the motor car was. Before the Model T, it was a luxury item. Every car was exclusively for the rich who could afford to indulge this new fad. The Model T cut to the quick of what the car is today. its popular
it helped to
transport.
Make, it helped to make America.
Yep.
It helped to make America what it is, for good or bad. Well, mainly for the good bits.
It put America
today.
On wheels.
Absolutely. But never mind what we think. I always do that, make some sort of definitive, massive grandstanding statement, and then say, but never mind what we think. It's up to you. Please go to Steve Speech Up, our Facebook page. You'll find pictures of these three iconic, for once, they are, all three of them, iconic, worthy of worship. Three iconic cars, and we need you to tell us which goes through from this group. But like I said, I think the Model T is going to be right there at the finishing line, duking it out with a couple of other cars. Which will they be? Keep listening to Speech Up to find out. I thank my guests, Guy Loveridge and Dave Richards. And like I said, we need your votes. So go to our Facebook page. You'll find us at Steve's Speech Up. Gentlemen, as ever, a pleasure. I really enjoyed that. Thank you, guys.
Good.
Brilliant.
Maybe not as many laughs as usual, because we've been quite serious, but... whenever the Model T comes up, I think, what do you think is going to be there at the end? What do you think is going to be there? When we do the final three, there's going to be a final three show. So what are the final three going to be? What do you reckon, Dave?
Mini, E-Type, Model T.
That's a very good list. I think I might squeeze the 911 in there, but I don't know if there's anything else that can go on.
Mini,
there.
E-Type, 356.
Ooh.
Gotta be the 356 ahead of the 911. Gotta be.
I do disagree with the Henry Ford prognosis, though. He was such an anti-Semite.
Yeah, he was a dreadful fascist.
Oh, a total Nazi. Yeah.
He was a dreadful fascist. But are we going to damn Dr. Porsche, who surely, if we were doing the greatest car, I think when we've done the greatest, we'll move on to the
designers
and the greatest. If we've got a top 10, Dr. Porsche is in the top 5 probably. But there's lots of pictures of him shooting the shit and having the crack with his mates, Mr. Goebbels and Hitler. Mr. Hitler, all that sort of stuff. So.
Yes.
Look, Dave, just because someone's a terrible Nazi, it doesn't make them a bad... No, hold on a minute.
Hold on a minute.
No, hold on a minute. Thanks, Dave. That's it for another edition of Speed Shop in association with Douglas Loveridge Publications, The Enthusiast Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed our Between the Wars special. Don't forget to vote for the greatest, which was the greatest pre-war people's car. Was it the Fiat Topolino, the little mouse? Was it the ingenious, inventive little Austin 7? Or was it the mighty, surely 16.5 million buyers can't be wrong, Ford Model T? Vote for your favourite at our Facebook page, Steve Speed Shop. See you back here on Fab Radio International, 7 o'clock next Wednesday.